The Bible Study on KFUO Radio is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, centered in the gospel of Jesus Christ in faithfulness, servanthood, responsiveness, and excellence, Concordia Seminary.
Time for hour number two of the Bible Study, the Ask the Pastor Hour. Numbers are 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. Well, I haven't actually even realized this, but it's Wisconsin Day here on our Bible Study Hours. Our first pastor, Pastor Nathan Metter, up in Plymouth, Wisconsin. Now we go to Kleiman, Wisconsin, for Pastor Dan Torkelson. And he tells me that he and Pastor Metter are old buddies, right?
Yeah, we've mentioned that before. Yeah, he and I go back, geez, 20 years, more than 20 years now.
All the way back to seminary or?
College.
College.
College. We were classmates at Concordia University. Mac 1, we started together in 1988.
And you got any good stories on Pastor Metter?
Oh, I do, but, you know.
But not today, right?
This is Christian Radio.
I understand. So how's everything at Zion Lutheran in Kleiman, Wisconsin?
Good. Beautiful day. Wonderful. Can't complain. Things are great.
Are
blessed by the Lord.
Are you close enough to Milwaukee to care about the Brewers?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah?
Yes, and I care very much about them these days.
Well, good.
I care about that bullpen. I care they do something about it.
It's good to know that you've got that on your mind, Pastor.
Yeah.
That brings a certain normalcy to you for all the rest of us.
Right.
Well, here's what I want to do here in the first part of our program today. If you look at the April 19th edition of USA Today, in the A section, you go to the forum, which is on page 9A, there is a headline that says, "Any faith can become violent." And then there is a drawing here which depicts the earth, the world. It just happened to be showing North America on their little planet there. And then there is a closed fist extended out of the heavenly clouds down in the direction of the earth. And it says, "A religious leader's misstep during a prayer incites a mob to storm his house, kill him, and parade his head around the streets. Islamists today? No. Christians in the 5th century." The article is written by Philip Jenkins. Let me read a couple of paragraphs here.
Mm-hmm.
It says, "It's the sort of scene that we associate all too easily with the religious fanaticism of the Middle East. A religious leader daringly tries to revise a popular prayer to reflect his particular slant on God. A furious mob storms his house, murders him, and parades his head around the streets on a pole as they yell that he is a blasphemer. Yes, theological debate between Christians could be a ferocious and unforgiving matter in the early church. The incident in question happened in the city we now call Istanbul in the year 511 A.D. The more we look at that era, the closer the resemblance we see between the behavior of violent Christian extremists then and that of Islamist radicals today. Change the names and the religious rhetoric, and the extremists look very much the same. The similarities are startling and genuinely uncomfortable for anyone who is used to drawing a stark night and day contrast between the two faiths." Let me just stop at that point right there. What are your thoughts as you listen to this story here unfolding on the radio? What's going through your mind?
Well, the first thing that's going through my mind is just sort of a scan of history. I'm trying to place myself in this is Constantinople, Istanbul. I think they're the same city.
Yep.
Constantinople in the 5th century, the 400s, a time of political turmoil, too. Although Constantinople was, I would argue, always in a certain form of political turmoil. But empires are changing at this time. Very interesting. Rome is dying. Meanwhile, Christianity is ascending to a position of dominance during this time as well. It's really not the early church. The author already has sort of depicted it as an early church. One of the, I think, the distinguishing characteristics of Christianity in its earliest days and the Christianity after about the 4th, 5th century is that it moves into a position of dominance in the West, it becomes big man on campus, I guess you could say. And that is, I think the early church ends when that happens, or at least that's one of the reasons why it ends. So it's not the new man on the block anymore. Fanatical? I don't know if it was that at that time. I don't know. Some of Constantinople's history plays in here, I would guess. But that's where I go first, as one who loves history.
Well, see, I guess the thing that I want to test with you is, for me anyway, an ever so slightly growing cynicism and suspicion. I find myself asking, well, now what's the purpose of this article? Great big headline here says, any faith can become violent. And so my suspicion is that the suicide bombers, the people who are killing innocent women and children as well as men, seem to be coming from Islam. And there are words of condemnation for that kind of behavior from all quarters of the world. But this person seems to be saying to you and me as Christians, hey, 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 not so fast, mister.
Right.
As you judge these Islamic fanatics, you got baggage in your past as well. And, you know, we just got done studying Acts 21, verses 27 through 36, I think it was, here on, in the first hour with your friend Nathan Metter. And that's all about the Jews having, you know, rioting in the temple. And taking Paul into custody and beating him up.
Right.
So, do you think that is a fair application, Pastor? Am I interpreting this properly? It's the wagging of the finger in my face by Philip Jenkins. Don't be so judgmental of these Islamic fanatics.
Well, I think here's where I would begin. Number one, I do think you do see in all religions, and yes, even within our own history as Christians, you can see certain groups trending toward the fanatical and toward the extreme. I think I would stop short of making across the board judgments about religion because of that. But, you know, I think you've spotted something that I've spotted too in discussions about this, and that's that kind of rhetoric is being used today. There's a general presupposition, I think, sometimes in the media, but you also hear this in people as well, in ordinary conversations as well, that religion has been behind a lot of violence throughout history and thus has a predisposition toward it. I can think of a sort of garden variety version of this that I underwent one time, where a person once said to me that they were having a hard time getting their child out of soccer class for confirmation class because the soccer coach said, well, you know, wars have been fought over religion. That was his reason why he was reluctant to let this person go to confirmation class, as if church was a dangerous place to be. I'm a pussycat, you know. I'm not going to war with anyone, but...
So you're a pacifist.
Well, I'm not a pacifist, but it is... I would agree that throughout history, you really can't avoid the conclusion that religion has lurked behind a lot of violence in the past. Unfortunately, I don't necessarily want to wear myself the responsibility for that, and I don't think most Christians I don't think most Christians should, or most proponents of other religions as well. I think most people of a religious, of any sort of religious background, usually tend to be peaceful people.
Well, let's continue here with paragraph two of the story by Philip Jenkins. He says, sometimes heretical takes on Christianity could drive a mob to violence. But on occasion, church authorities themselves orchestrated violence, very deliberately. One of the intellectual superstars of the 5th century Egypt was a brilliant woman called Hypatia, a scientist and philosopher. Her religious skepticism and her gender angered the city's bishop, Cyril, whose political position allowed him to do more than just fume quietly in his palace. In particular, he commanded the loyalty of turbulent army of monks who would do anything for the honor of their faith and their church. Whether or not Cyril gave the order in 415, the monks lynched and dismembered Hypatia. Cyril, oddly, is now venerated as a saint. I'm getting more suspicious here, Pastor. I'm beginning to think there's an undertone of an agenda.
Yeah, and now it is intersecting with, you know, very real church history. Cyril's one of those characters who's often associated with that transition I mentioned before. When the church goes from being, I don't want to say subversive, but there's a certain sort of, in the early church, there's a certain sort of counterculturalism that plays itself out in the early church through the early centuries after Christ. And now the church has converted Roman emperors and everything else, and it's in a position of power and authority, and the church does have questions to wrestle with in that regard. And that particular figure, he's venerated as a saint in some circles. He's also the subject of much historical speculation with regard to the authority of the church. And I guess I would argue I'm not a great subscriber to his theories on the authority of the church. But
well, he goes on to comment on monks as militias. He says, nor was such a criminal outrage a freak or rare event. In the 5th and 6th centuries, Christian monks served as private militias, holy headbreakers, whom charismatic bishops could turn out at will to sack pagan temples, to rough up or kill opponents, and to overawe rival theologians. These were not rogue monks or clergy gone bad, but loyal followers of the churches, doing exactly what was expected of them. When cities or regions divided along lines of theology or faith, as they often did, rival bishops and monks literally fought for domination in the hills and on the streets. Bishops mobilized an impressive amount of muscle to promote their causes, making them powerful independent political actors. Between 450 and 650 A.D., during what I have called, meaning Philip Jenkins, the Jesus Wars, inter-Christian conflicts and purges killed hundreds of thousands and all but wrecked the Roman Empire. Reading such stories of religious violence today, most of us naturally think of Islamic extremism, which finds such a convenient face in the mullahs and ayatollahs who have become so notorious in Iran, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Lebanon. During the recent Iraqi elections, for instance, the Obama administration was dismayed to see the enormous strength of Shiite leader Muqtada al-Sadr, a celebrated cleric who uses his paramilitary Mahdi army to control whole cities. And from there, it is not too large a jump to assume that the rampant violence of such countries, all the intolerance and fanaticism, must be deeply rooted in the faith of Islam. Perhaps, we think, Islam never has recovered from the warlike teachings of the Quran, which stands in such sharp contrast to the peaceful words of the Bible. Moreover, Islam apparently demands slavish devotion to charismatic holy men. Some observers even ask whether Islam can ever be compatible with a peaceful and democratic society. Let's stop at that point. I get the impression here that our author feels that the world would be better off without any Christianity, any Islam, any Judaism, anything that is associated with religion or this heavenly extended fist in the picture that I described to you before. Are you getting that sense?
Yes, I'm getting that sense as well. And here's where there were actually, I think, certain aspects of that last section that you read that actually were quite helpful, because what I think where this author makes his mistake is he makes his mistake in saying this is this kind of behavior plays along with the fundamental message of both religions, and yet he puts that contrast up between the warlike Quran and the peace-like Bible. And I think, you know, as far as Christian history is concerned and that sort of extremism, we Christians should be honest. We should recognize that, yes, these things have happened, and they happen largely because we lost our way, largely because we as a church have failed to hold to our central and core teachings. And I always look at that period in history where Cyril lives and you know, at the decline of the Roman Empire and whatever, is a classic example of when that really starts to happen within Christianity. And it's not that the first centuries of the church were perfect either, but I think one of the real fundamental shifts that takes place during this time for us as Christians is a shift away from authority to power. And a lot of people would think that those two words are synonyms, but they're not. When Jesus says in Matthew 28, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me, what is he specifically referring to? He's referring to the authority to forgive sins or not to. And then he instructs the disciples, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing and teaching. That's an unusual authority. That's a very peaceful authority. Within that forgiveness, there is real peace. But as the church starts to elevate itself and rise into positions of authority, influence, it has influence over Roman emperors, it has influence over kings and other things, it loses that sense of Christ-like authority and starts to take on worldly notions of power, which actually run very contrary to the heart of our message with the good news. And this plays out, actually, I mean, it doesn't play out in such extremism all the time, but it plays out through the whole Middle Ages. And the church still wrestles with it today. I would argue that there's shades of this problem in the Catholic controversy right now. It's a problem for a church that is struggling to be a church and not some sort of pure governance structure.
Well, we have discussed here on our Ask the Pastor Hour on a number of occasions some recent survey results which seem to indicate that while the group of unbelievers, whether they call themselves agnostics or atheists, really is not growing, there is a gap opening up between those people who call themselves Christians and those people who they've been dubbed the nuns. When asked on a survey what their religious affiliation is, they write N-O-N-E, none.
Right.
And that group has expanded by maybe 10%, 10 percentage points in the last decade or so. Do you think that an article like this, an opinion like this, and this is on the forum page, so nobody's trying to pull a fast one here. This author clearly is expressing his opinion. Do you think that this author is trying to open up the gap even further for the people who already distrust religion, distrust perhaps Christian institutions, and are now putting distance between themselves and that identity? Do you think this author is trying to work that angle?
He could be. I mean, at the very least, he's truly reflective of a growing way of thinking in the world today, no question. There's a version of this that I think pastors are used to dealing with where someone will tell you, well, why would I go to church? Why would I spend time with, I believe in God, but why, I don't need the church. Why would I spend time with all those hypocrites, those people who don't practice what they preach? I think that's a common way of thinking, and he's advancing it, and he's probably, whether he intends to make it worse or not, he's going to make it worse through such an article. I'm one who struggles to try to put the best construction on everything, including
things I don't
agree with.
Well, God bless you. That's what you ought to do.
Yeah, including things I don't agree with, but you know, I do recognize that an article like that certainly does probably more harm than good for reconciling a biblical understanding of these realities with the problem at hand. The problem at hand is that there is this growing divide that you've mentioned, and as I wrestle with that as a pastor, I just simply try to reference people back to the truth and say, well, okay, someone says to me, all right, I believe in God, but I don't believe in the church. Why would I want to spend time with all those hypocrites? The pastor in me says, well, of course, that's exactly what they are. The Christian church, perhaps even more so than other radical religions or non-radical religions, the Christian church has always addressed that as a reality. We've always said, look, we live in a sinful world. Until we're released from this body, we're going to still have a problem with sin. We're going to act contrary to what we believe. We are not going to practice what we preach. We are going to be hypocrites. Sometimes we're going to be Pharisees. Sometimes we're going to be tax collectors or other sinners. This is why Jesus came into the world. This is why forgiveness and grace are so valuable. I think the one thing that I could bring to this argument and this author's writing that would still distance Christianity in its truest form from this argument is the fact that Christianity teaches at its root a message of forgiveness through the blood of Jesus Christ. Why would we teach that if we didn't have these problems?
Let's take a telephone call here, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Hi, Bill. You're on the Bible study.
Yes. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I hope this, what I'm going to say, is kind of connected with the overall view of this thing. Recently, we've had a lot of violence and crime here in St. Louis, like any other city in the world. And some of the community are in upheaval about all the violence and everything that's going on, and they'll have ministers from different churches out there talking and everything. And I always hear, it seems like there's always blame put on things that aren't really the main reason for the violence. They talk about, well, we got a lot of dilapidated buildings around
shifting
here. Shifting
blame?
And, put it on that. And we just got to get more programs to keep the youth or whatever off the streets and everything. But you never hear them talking much about sin. The ministers aren't out there talking about it's sin. And that we have to, the ministers seem like they don't want to talk about sin. A lot of this crime and stuff is because we're sinners, and there's crime. And that goes for even what you're talking about, the different religious groups throughout the world. They always blame it on people who are fanatic or whatever, it's bad.
Let's see what Pastor Torkelson has to say.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Pastor?
Oh, amen. That's what I was driving at. We, at least in Christianity, I think in the truest form of Christianity, we have the honesty to say that, and maybe the love to say that. Unfortunately, it is not necessarily what the world wants to hear. To talk about sin is really to address something that, well, I mean, our own sinful natures just do not want to hear that.
I want to take up, in light of Bill's call, a specific point that you made here, and we probably have to carry this through the break here. But I hear this a lot. It's been said many, many times here on our Bible study programs, either in the 10 o'clock or the 11 o'clock hour. And the story goes something like, well, you know, there are certain people, when you talk to them about coming to church, they say something like, why would I want to come to your church? It's just full of hypocrites.
Mm-hmm.
To which the pastor says, well, yeah.
Exactly.
Now, that moment right there, I suspect, is a disconnect moment, because the pastor who makes that point, albeit on the Bible study, where the context of the Bible study is different than the confrontation between the person who is perhaps a disaffected member or a member who hasn't been in church for a while, that's a little bit different context. But I sometimes think that the pastor believes that he's made an exquisite point to the complainer. Oh, well, of course it's a place where there are hypocrites. That's who we are. We're sinners. We say things like the church is a hospital for sinners. And the pastor then, I think, sometimes believes that he has made the perfect theological point, and he probably has. But I don't think that the disaffected person hears it. I think when the disaffected person hears it, they don't say, oh, so hypocrites are really sinners, and that's what your church is for. I don't think they do that. I think they leave that conversation probably more often than not saying, you see, I said they were full of hypocrites, and the pastor says they are too. I don't want anything to do with it. And both people in the discussion feel vindicated, but no progress has been made. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes. I'm going to disagree a little with you, but that's because
feel free to disagree.
Well, do we have time?
Well, you probably would be better off if you held your rebuttal to the other side of the break here. All right. Pastor Dan Torkelson with us. He's going to straighten me out on the other side of the break here on our Ask the Pastor program. Your questions and comments are welcome here on this or any other subject, as it is an open phone program. Come on in. We'd like to hear from you. 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. I still have those numbers memorized after Share-a-thon. We'll be right back.
Back in the day, a man became a pastor by moving to the seminary. Today, Concordia Seminary has 7 routes that lead to pastoral ministry. The Specific Ministry Pastor Program is a 4-year program where men become pastors through the World Wide Web while they continue to live and work in the congregations they are already serving. Keeping up with the times, that's Concordia Seminary.
KFUO Radio wants to help you promote your event. Every hour after the news, we read a datebook item to publicize sausage suppers, special church events, concerts, and fellowship opportunities. If you'd like to place an item on the KFUO datebook, send the information directly to Diane Summers at this email address, dsummers@kfuo.org. That's the datebook, a service from your friends at KFUO Radio.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
The pro-abortion health care bill passed, and lawsuits are already being filed to stop it. Dr. Jane Orient, Executive Director of the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, says the bill spells the end of freedom in medicine as we know it. The group says it wants to preserve individual liberty and prevent the bankruptcy of the U.S. generally and Medicare and Social Security specifically. In addition, the attorneys general of 19 states have filed suits to prevent the bill from being enacted. They say it's unconstitutional because it infringes on the rights of states and individuals to manage their own affairs. Pro-lifers oppose the new law because it poses an enormous threat to innocent human life and medical professionals who want to protect them.
Check out Life Issues on Facebook and stay more informed than you've ever been.
Who's Rights? I'm Steve Coleman with today's Religion Roundup. The Supreme Court hears arguments today on whether a law school can deny campus recognition to a Christian group whose leaders must subscribe to its beliefs and code of conduct. The University of California's Hastings Law School says the Christian Legal Society shouldn't get the funding and benefits of an official campus group because it requires officers and voting members to share its beliefs, including that Christians should not engage in sex outside marriage between a man and a woman. Barry Lynn of Americans United for Separation of Church and State says,
Christian Legal Society wants to be able to discriminate against gays and people who are not Christian.
The Society's Kim Colby responds,
the idea that a religious group choosing its leaders according to its religious beliefs, that would be considered discrimination is really absurd.
She adds that the Christian group's code addresses sexual conduct, not orientation. I'm Steve Coleman.
KFUO Radio reaches around the world with the good news of Jesus Christ. We broadcast and webcast Christ-centered programs at no charge to the listener. However, these programs are not free to produce. KFUO Radio has production costs, web streaming costs, and a whole range of costs associated with running our ministry. Your support is necessary for us to continue this worldwide outreach. Please consider making a donation today, and thank you for your prayers. KFUO Radio, we are where you are.
Hi, I'm Dara Torres. I've won 12 Olympic medals, but my proudest moments come from being a mom.
I'm Attorney General Chris Koster. We all know how important it is for kids to lead an active lifestyle. Let's get our kids started today, whether it's in a school activity, on a sports team, or volunteering in our community.
Get your kids off to a fast start on the road to a healthy lifestyle. Visit AskListenLearn.com and say yes to a healthy lifestyle and no to underage drinking.
This message sponsored by the Century Council.
It's the Ask the Pastor Bible Study. I'm Chuck Rathard, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Pastor Dan Torkelson is with us. Friend of Pastor Nathan Metter, by the way, which we're still trying to figure out if that's a good thing or a bad thing. And he is about to, he's going to disagree with the host. This doesn't happen all that often.
No. Well, I'm going to... Now I feel like I'm reversing a little bit. During the break, I thought about your observation, and yeah. I would say that if I were to just take your observation at an argumentative level, a sort of clinical level, as if the let's say it's a disaffected member of the congregation who says, why would I want to be with all those hypocrites on Sunday morning? And I'm, as a pastor, addressing them because I'm concerned that they're not receiving Christ's gifts of forgiveness in life. And I simply advance the argument, well, precisely, they're hypocrites. Absolutely. And they say, you know, okay, well, great. Pastor just advanced my argument. Sure, I can feel like I, you know, got the theology right. They are sinners. They act hypocritically. They don't practice what they preach all the time. Neither do I. But I think, I know when I've had those discussions, especially in that kind of context with a disaffected member, or perhaps even, well, sometimes I'll just, you know, drop in on new neighbors or something like that to the church and knock on the door, and this discussion comes up. It's, to me, it's very interesting. I still have to look at this person as a person, and I have to, in this kind of discussion, I have to address it in terms of, this isn't a concern about the members of Zion nearly as much as it's a concern about you. You've told me that they're sinners, and I don't want to be argumentative, but the point I usually try to drive to in these kind of discussions is, how are they different from you? And hopefully where that discussion eventually leads, you know, you try to do this nicely, but as a pastor, you have a responsibility to address people where they live and recognize that their number one problem is sin, too. It seems to me the only difference is that the people in church on Sunday morning are sinners who know what they need and know where to go to get it. And that is the forgiveness of sins. I think for me personally, I like to try to steer that discussion in the direction of, don't you think you need that too? And so I don't like to just let them off the hook. And I guess if I were to put 10 pastors in a room and ask them about that scenario, because I think we've all dealt with it, I think they'd all agree with that, too. I think they'd all say, look, we tried to keep that discussion focused on them, because ultimately when you say, why would I want to go to church because of all those hypocrites there, that's a diversion. That's passing the buck, like the caller indicated before the break.
Yeah. Well, that may be the most important point, because,
right,
because now you've really hit on it. When it comes to the business of communication, and this is what I think that escapes many people, is that the accusation that the church is full of hypocrites is not really an accusation on the part of the disaffected person. It is a rhetorical device,
mm-hmm,
designed to sidetrack the conversation.
Right.
And it's usually successfully played, it seems to me, when it does get played. But now, with that in mind, I have to ask you this question, because in that sort of stalemate that I just described there between pastor and disaffected person, whether that person is a member of the church or not, it seems to me that this article that we're talking about today in the USA Today, titled Any Faith Can Become Violent, strengthens the argument of the disaffected person. It puts you more on the defensive. So
right,
with that in mind, I ask you this question. What does the word anathema mean?
Anathema means, the actual Greek is escaping me here, but it's the sort of absolutely most forbidden thing. I think the way I would describe it, is described as anathema. It's utterly and totally condemned and forbidden.
Okay, that's an excellent definition.
Right.
At least that matches the one that my working definition. I don't know the Greek either, but my memory is that during the Reformation, as Luther was pursuing his goals, his theological goals, and the Roman Catholic Church was responding to them, there were some anathemas exchanged, were there not?
Yes, there were.
And so when Luther and his compadres, those Reformation scholars, advanced the notion that we are saved by grace through faith on account of Christ alone, that assertion was pronounced as most forbidden and condemned by the Roman Catholic Church, was it not?
Right.
And then the those who became known as the Lutherans condemned theology from the Roman Church, which asserted that salvation was a combination of both the work of Christ and the work of men. Am I okay so far?
Yes, you're absolutely okay.
So here is the article here as it continues, written by Philip Jenkins, who, by the way, is the author of the book Jesus Wars and something called The Lost History of Christianity.
Yeah.
The USA Today says he has a joint appointment as the Edwin Earl Sparks Professor of the Humanities in History and Religious Studies at Penn State and as Distinguished Senior Fellow at the Institute for Studies of Religion at Baylor. So this guy has some credentials, and he continues his article. He says, but reading Christian history suggests just how wrong just an analysis would be. Out of control clergy, religious demagogues with their consecrated militias, religious parties usurping the functions of the state, these were the common currency of the Christian world just a few decades after the Roman Empire made Christianity its official religion. Whatever he might have thought of his theology, Cyril the Christian bishop would immediately have strong fellow feeling for al-Sadr, the Islamic mullah. Like al-Sadr, Cyril, too, disciplined his followers with pronouncements that cast deviance beyond the protection of the church and the law. Christians then called them anathemas. Muslims today call them fatwas. In retelling the story of Christian atrocities, I'm not trying to blacken the reputation of the church, but rather to suggest that given the appropriate social and political circumstances, given a sufficiently weak state mechanism, any religion can be used to justify savagery and extremism. None of the violence or intolerance commonly seen in modern-day Islam is, so to speak, in the DNA of that religion, any more than of Christianity. Change the circumstances, and any religion, too, can become the basis of a sane and peaceful society. Now, the reason I wanted to read this section to you is because you, as a Lutheran pastor, have some anathemas in your confessional writings, don't you?
Yes.
Do you feel like this article has suddenly hit closer to home?
Yes. I find that's an interesting paragraph. I found myself. I love how he gave with one hand and took back with the other. If we go back to Cyril of Jerusalem for just a second, I'll come back to the Lutheran question here in just a second. If we go back to Cyril of Jerusalem, yeah, you're talking about a little bit of a political void there, and the church was sometimes looked at in that realm of providing some sort of stability in a more chaotic period in history. That doesn't necessarily justify the actions, but he's making actually a pretty good point. Now, if we come back around to Lutheranism and the history of Lutheranism, as the Reformation began to grow and as the Catholic Church's credibility was under pretty severe scrutiny, especially in the northern part of Europe, yeah, there was a lot of political instability, including a 30 years war in there somewhere, over some of these realities. I don't know that when the Lutherans declared their anathemas that they were pushing for some sort of violent revolution against Rome. I think it was a whole bunch of circumstances that led to the more violent aspects of the later part of the Reformation, and even in the earlier part of the Reformation as well. Quite interestingly, I would argue too that the Lutheran anathemas are still rooted in Scripture. Take a look at Galatians 1. Paul himself calls down anathemas on those in the Galatian congregations who were proposing a salvation by works. I think the Lutherans would have told you that they were right in line with Galatians 1 in calling down anathemas on that. And Paul even goes so far as to say even if an angel from heaven were to preach a message different than the one I gave you, salvation by grace, then, you know, let him be eternally condemned.
Well, the one thing that seems to be perhaps the primary outcome of this editorial
is
for the slightly informed or uninformed person that, bottom line, all religions are the same. And depending on their circumstances, they may become violent. They may not be violent in their tenets, but in their circumstances, they may become violent. And that's basically because all religion is the same. Different deities, different leaders, different messiahs, whatever it is, But at the end of the day, they're all the same. Do you hear him making that claim?
I hear him making that claim. I don't agree with it at all. We've already touched on why I wouldn't agree with that, and that is just simply that lurking behind all violence is still a sinful nature. It's not about the religion and the religion's precepts. It's about what's real about you and me and everybody, and that is our sinful natures and a predisposition toward that sort of thing when the circumstances conspire just right. Violence can happen.
What did you mean when you said, "I love the way he gives with one hand, takes away with the other"?
Well, that last paragraph seemed to be a little bit of a shift, and he's got a point. His point there is that within certain political circumstances, it's interesting how religion reacts. And he's right. You can observe that through history. That's something you can see. I think you can see that the Christian church from, I'd say, maybe this is ballparking a little bit, but 400 AD through about 700 AD is filling a political void in Europe. And so it gets looked to for a lot of things it didn't used to get looked to, and it has to be able to adjust to that. And that's exactly how Rome eventually becomes Rome. You know, this gigantic church body with all of this influence is because during that period there was a political vacuum going on. The church was being looked to settle all sorts of things. And I think factor in now the sin factor as well in the church leaders, you're not always going to get happy results when the church has to cross kingdoms, as we would say, over into the left-hand kingdom and start providing governance over society. It's not going to be a happy result. And I think, you know, in Islam you have the same problem. You see religion and politics very closely intermingled, and it's not always a good intermingling. Not that I'm arguing for a wall of separation between church and state either, but factor in sinful natures, factor in strong opinions, factor in anger and whatever. You can see these sort of situations happening. And it's not necessarily because the religion says what it says. It is largely, I think, an issue of sin mixed with the political situation of the time. I think that's a good explanation of what's happening with radical Islam in our world today. I think that's a very good explanation, too, of why, of that period I mentioned before in Christian history as well. Actually, it's a good explanation of the whole Middle Ages, to be quite honest with you.
Here I'm just going to speak for myself here and submit myself to your correction. But in the just in the last section that I read here on the anathemas or fatwas, there are what I think are deliberately selected provocative words: demagogues, militias, deviants, atrocities, savagery, extremism, violence, intolerance. I think it's pretty provocative language, and embedded in all of that is this sentence: "In retelling the story of Christian atrocities, I'm not trying to blacken the reputation of the church." And I'm thinking, that's exactly what you're trying to do.
Whether
now,
you're trying even to do it or not.
Am I jumping to an erroneous conclusion?
No. Sometimes writers, I think, don't always appreciate what their readers are going to hear. I mean, let me put that into a... if he earnestly believes that, then I would say he's guilty of not appreciating what his readers are going to hear. He's writing this to USA Today. Chuck, you tell me, who are the people that read USA Today?
I would say that they're well-educated people, probably people of some means, successful people.
Right. They're not his people, though. You just gave me the curriculum vitae of this man, this man's background.
Right.
And in an academic environment, he's going to say something like that, and it's going to be taken, I think, a little differently than in a more broad public environment like USA Today. And I'm not knocking anyone's intelligence when I say that, but when you put an argument like that into the USA Today rather than into an academic journal, you're going to have a lot of people misread you. That's just what's going to happen. I mean, I fight that battle every Sunday. It's very easy to step into the pulpit and be misunderstood. And you know your people.
Yeah.
And it still happens. I've heard pastors joke about Murphy's Rule. If you can be misunderstood, you will be. That's sort of the Murphy's Rule of pastoral communication. I personally feel that you can say that you're not trying to besmirch the image of Christianity. That doesn't necessarily mean that the reader's going to take it that way. And I think you put that in that forum, that public, you put that idea out there, yeah, you're going to do damage to the reputation of the church.
I think that my opinion is that Philip Jenkins has thrown down the gauntlet here to Pastor Dan Torkelson. I think Philip Jenkins has said, listen, man, I have academic credentials as long as my arm,
mm-hmm.
and my study tells me that Christianity is guilty of atrocities and is certainly not in a position to make any claims that it has a higher moral or divine level than Islam, which Christianity seems to be doing. And I am alarmed that as many as 7, maybe 8 out of 10 people in the United States claim to be Christians, and they seem to be laboring under this delusion that their religion is superior to others. And I'm here to tell you on Monday, April 19th, that's a joke. Now, that's what I think he's saying to you, Pastor Torkelson, since you are a pastor, since you hold an office,
mm-hmm.
you have official duties in what we would otherwise call the Christian church. Are you going to take it up, take up the challenge?
Sure. Sure, I'll take up the challenge. I will say, first of all, you know, once sin enters into the world, in Genesis chapter 3, what do you see? In Genesis chapter 4, you see violence. You see people who are God's people carrying
out. Cain and Abel,
right. You see people who are God's people carrying out violence on one another. The mistake that Cain made was to become jealous with Abel, and not recognize, I suppose, the devil's work in his own jealousy. If you go back to Genesis 3 and the fall into sin, it's actually a very similar dynamic. When God appears on the scene after Adam and Eve fall into sin, he appears to Adam first and says, Adam, what happened here? What did Adam do? Adam blamed Eve and God for what happened. And this particular writer is... that Adam was wrong, this particular writer is wrong. Don't necessarily blame Christianity for those atrocities. Blame this as the work of the devil, the world, and our sinful flesh. Put the blame on that first, and then deal with your own sin in this regard. That's sort of the way I teach this in church. I think a lot of times, even in church conflicts, just within congregations, we're so busy blaming one another and forgetting that the devil's the first actor in all of this. You know, put the blame where it belongs first. Because Eve, I think, actually got it right. When God appeared on the scene and talked to Eve, he said, well, what have you done? Eve says, the serpent deceived me and I ate. And the reason I think Eve got it right is because God came down on the serpent first, before anyone else. I think the reason we can tell that Adam got it wrong is because Adam got told about the curse regarding death. And Eve actually stands in there and puts the blame in the right spot. Why does violence happen in the world, whether it happens within an Islamic context or a Christian context or any other context? Violence happens because of the work of the devil in the world and how that devil plays with the sinful natures of us all. That's why violence happens. If you want to ring that up as the fault of Christianity or showing that Christianity has no more moral standing than any other church body or any other religion, okay, did Christianity in its truest form ever claim it had more moral standing? We talk about sin. We put sin out there on the table. We talk about your sin and mine. I think where we have the superior message is that we have a Savior who takes on our salvation for us because he knows that we can't solve the sinful nature. He knows that we're going to have tendencies toward violence. He's the picture of it. God's faithful stuck Jesus on a cross in an act of violence, took his life. It was his faithful people who did that. It was his people who said they believed in God, who then slandered him and nailed him to his cross.
I have a feeling that Philip Jenkins might say to Dan Torkelson, Pastor, you call yourself a Christian? You'd say yes.
Mm-hmm.
You believe that your religion is the correct one?
Mm-hmm.
You would say yes. You believe that the Bible is God's truth? You would say yes. You believe that Jesus is the only way to heaven?
Mm-hmm.
You would say yes. And then he might say something like, you see, you're all set up. And given the right set of circumstances, you too, Pastor Torkelson, would commit violence, would commit atrocities like we've seen down through the ages. How would you respond?
I can't. Well, I guess I can't deny it. But I don't think that necessarily...
So he wins.
What?
So then Philip Jenkins wins.
No, I don't think that establishes his point. If that's what he says to me, all he's really saying to me is that, okay, I'm going to choose to believe what I want to believe here. Your truth is different than mine. I think he's gone totally postmodern at that point. And that's a great thing about being postmodern. We can be, one of the great marks of being postmodern is we can sort of agree to disagree. But one of the things that he still has to reckon with is that there is one distinguishing characteristic of Christianity. And that distinguishing characteristic is a God who loves the world enough to take care of this problem himself. And offer us the forgiveness of sins in this life, because we're still going to need it until that time when we're taken to be with him in heaven. And we are the only religion that has a God that loves people enough to put the solution on the table. Islam will tell you, keep working at it. Keep working at it. Maybe you'll live up to Allah's standards. I have a happier message, and if this man would just open his ears and listen, maybe he'd come around, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's how he reacts. I still don't think he's right.
I just thought that this drawing, this picture here that goes along with the article of what appears to be God's heavenly fist extended downward toward the planet served as a kind of a tip-off.
Mm-hmm.
From now, I don't know if Philip Jenkins saw this illustration or if he approved or what, but I thought it served as a kind of a tip-off as to what kind of an opinion we were going to be reading here,
right,
in this forum article in USA Today.
Yeah, there's not anything fundamentally wrong with God. These are all things you can spot in human behavior in a fallen world, quite apart from God. When Christians resort to violence, they have pretty much left their God behind. And that's the definition of sin itself. When we depose God from his throne and sit on it ourselves, that's when violence and all sorts of bad things start to happen.
Pastor Torkelson, this was, I thought, a challenging and intellectual piece here, and I very much appreciate your insight on it, because I think you handled it very well.
Well, thank you.
I look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Yeah, I'll enjoy that.
All righty, good.
Take care.
Pastor Dan Torkelson of Zion Lutheran Church in Kleiman, Wisconsin, our guest here on our Bible study program, Ask the Pastor. Now, tomorrow we're going to kind of straddle a couple of chapters on the Bible study. We'll pick it up at verse 37 of Acts 21 and take it pretty deep into Acts chapter 22 all the way to verse 39. That'll be Pastor John Schmidtke's assignment next time on the Bible study. And our Ask the Pastor guest will be Pastor Stephen Tice, St. Paul Lutheran Church in Columbia, Illinois. He will join us for your questions and comments on our Ask the Pastor program. Thank you for listening. Thank you for, again, for all of your support during Share-a-thon in the days just preceding our Bible study program today. $121,000 in donations, and we are all personally grateful to our Lord Jesus Christ for that wonderful blessing and for your faithful support. Join us for the Bible study tomorrow.
Listen to Chuck Rathard and guest pastors Monday through Friday at this same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for the Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the web at kfuo.org. Download programs from the Bible Study archives at kfuo.org. The Bible Study is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis.